Picture a large plaid sofa, blues and greens, sturdy fabric. It was the only good thing left from a relationship gone bad. But that's another story. Anyway, the sofa was a lot of trouble. But I liked it. And at the time, years ago, it was by far the nicest piece of furniture I owned, which was not saying much. I ended up dragging this heavy thing with me every time I moved, which was a lot back then. The very last place I moved this sofa, something unusual happened. I was downsizing into an old carriage house, a garage apartment that sat behind an imposing home in Dallas. The owner of that house was a widower, and he lived alone. It was dusk, and a friend was helping move that plaid sofa up a narrow exterior staircase that led to the apartment's door. We got to the top landing, and that's when my friend said he saw the owner of the main house watching us from an upstairs window. My friend joked, "I don't think he likes your furniture." We moved the sofa inside and collapsed on it, exhausted. Then I heard a rumble and vibrations underneath us. The automatic garage door was opening. Glancing out the window, I watched an Audi pull into the driveway, a car I had assumed was already parked inside the garage below. I stepped outside and greeted the owner of the home. He had been out for the evening. Later, I pulled my friend aside. That figure at the window he had seen? Well, that was impossible. The house, as I now knew, had been empty. I'm Christopher Wynn, and this is Strange. Years ago in a gritty Dallas neighborhood, not far from where mechanical Big Tex still greets guests to the State Fair of Texas each fall, Jason Cohen opened a tiny storefront. He called it Forbidden Books and Video, and he shared the space with a tattoo parlor. He was 24. The shop advertised its specialties as 60s erotica, anarchy, postmodern, philosophy, murder, adult comics, and, of course, bizarre books and videos. A story in the Dallas Morning News about its opening described it as a full-service sicko shop. The piece was somewhat tongue-in-cheek. When the reporter asked if Cohen's parents knew what he was up to, he replied, "Yeah, they were in here yesterday. They actually funded me." No surprise, Jason's shop attracted a very eclectic clientele, and the boundaries between their fantasies and reality were sometimes hard to discern. And hey, before we continue, I should give a brief warning. Some of the content in the story is disturbing and deals with mature subject matter, so listener discretion is advised. Also, a reminder that this is literally a podcast called Strange. Okay. Here's Jason.
The idea of Forbidden Books was that, you know, I carried these things that were like banned books at one time, or, you know, books that just you couldn't find in your local bookshop or your library. Things that at the time, being pre-internet, you would have to really seek out this kind of thing. There just wasn't a place where you could go and look up a catalog. I mean, there were companies that specialized in selling oddball tapes, but basically, I put them all together into a library where people could rent them. As the store started to grow, the interesting and unusual oddball people really started to flock towards the store. This town is so rigid, and I'm creating this place where people could come and feel comfortable if they were an outcast or an oddball. I knew there was sort of a seedy underbelly, and what I was doing was trying to tap into that and create a place for people to come and sort of an outpost for that. And it's what happened. I mean, people started gravitating towards the store. A lot of my customer and clientele, of course, were people who were pierced or tattooed or looked, you know, like they were part of this underground culture. But really, as I began to see the clientele grow, it was more people that you couldn't really tell, you know, they were more sort of straight-laced, or, you know, people would come in every day, you know, dressed, you know, in their nice suits, coming from work on their lunch break, and they were renting these strange tapes and buying weird books. We had a lot of drug books, you know, how to grow marijuana. We had the Anarchist Cookbook. That was kind of one of our top sellers. I started to get this regular clientele coming in, and I would notice, you know, certain people had little interesting intrinsic things about them that I would kind of take note on. And some of my best friends that I've met, you know, over the years were people that were these regular customers that would come in and would ask me for these things. At first, you know, I was kind of, even though I was interested in all these things, there was a little bit of a creep factor involved where, you know, there'd be this one customer that would come in and, you know, he was very quiet and very sort of calm. And he would always ask me the same questions every time. He's like, "Hey, man, have you got any new pictures of anything new that's got some, I need to see pictures of blood and violence." And the guy was just the most calm and peaceful person. But there was something inside of his head that made him gravitate towards these really dark and morbid things. And, you know, it was my duty to try and find these things for these people. There was this man, I'll call him Ben, the trucker. He drove one of the big rig, like a big 18-wheeler truck. He would pull up in front of my shop. And Ben came in, I remember the first time, and he was just dressed in work clothes, very nondescript. He kind of said, "Hey," you know, introduced himself, and he pulled out probably 20 or 30 videotapes, like, out of my collections, and set up an account, rented them, like, 30 tapes. And at first I was like, "Oh, okay, you know, this guy's going to rip me off, you know, he's going to take 30 tapes and just disappear." You know, he took the tapes, and he went into his truck, which he kept parked out in front of my shop, and I noticed, you know, hey, the truck's not moving. Ben basically sat in his truck and watched these tapes, and probably about two or three hours later, he came back in with this pile of tapes. You know, I was kind of dumbfounded. I was like, "Wow, you know, did you get to watch all those tapes? I mean, you took, like, you know, like at least 25 tapes, and you only had them for a few hours." And he's like, yeah, you know, man, you know, I just kind of scanned through them. At the time, I had built up this really good collection of videotapes of, like, 60s exploitation and sexploitation films and 70s softcore porn and schlock films. So he was renting, you know, these things by the pile. And then he would, you know, he'd take off in his truck and come back, you know, a few months later. I think he crossed the country back and forth doing his deliveries. And every time he'd come through Texas, he'd stop and do the same thing. You know, as I became a little bit more comfortable talking with him, decided to, you know, ask him, "Hey, you know, what are you doing? There's no way you could watch all these things." And he told me the story of when he was in high school, when he had first started driving. He was with a girlfriend, and they had been driving down the road, and he lost control of the car, and the car flipped, and he flew out of the car, and his girlfriend at the time flew out of the car. And after the car crashed and he kind of came to out of this whole crazy wreck, he looked over and his girlfriend was laying next to him, and the only thing he could see was that her legs were askewed and her dress had hiked up, and he could see her stockings and her garters. And he told me that from that point on, he was obsessed with, you know, images of legs and pictures of legs, women's legs, and only that. That was the only thing he could, like, focus on. And he told me, well, you know, what I'm doing is I'm renting these videos and I'm getting in my truck and I scan through them and I look for only the leg sections where there's a picture of women's legs. And then I dub them to another tape. And so I'm compiling this collection of leg shots. And it wasn't just videos. I mean, he would buy just stacks and stacks of like fetish magazines of legs and anything that had shots of legs in it. And this went on for years. I later found out Ben was actually wearing fishnet hose underneath his clothing. And I never thought about it, you know, like, wow, this is really like he's got this close connection with legs and all these things. And underneath his work clothes and his boots, he's got fishnet hose on. And from that moment on, I was just like, this is really one of my favorite customers now. The way my store was set up, there was a hole in the door and I had a little board there. And when people would return their films after hours, they would drop them through this little slot and they'd slide down this little thing I had there, little deal. And the videos would slide down and make a pile at the bottom of the door. And I began to notice that people were starting to drop their own random tapes through the slots. Like some days I'd come in and, you know, there'd be my pile of my tapes with their label with the skull and crossbones on them that said forbidden. And then there'd be like these random tapes, some of them marked, some of them unmarked, that were just kind of mixed in. And I remember one of the first tapes that I picked up, I looked at it and it just said, Sloppy Fun. I was like, oh, what is this? And so I put it in, of course, I mean, as fast as I could to find out what is Sloppy Fun. You know, I was thinking, oh no, this is going to be some sort of, you know, crazy, lurid, homemade pornography or something. But what it turned out to be was a picture of this woman up to her waist in this pit covered in mud, wallowing in this mud. I was kind of intrigued. I was like, well, you know, well, all right, interesting. And I got two or three more of these things. This man came in one day and he had kind of long, greasy hair, kind of hippie looking. And he said, hey man, my name's Tim and I was curious if you liked my tapes. And I kind of looked at him like, oh, I don't know. I mean, what are you talking about? He was like, yeah, you know, I've been dropping you my tapes. I was just curious if you like them. I'm Tim, I'm the Mud Man. He explained to me that he's part of this community, and it's this sort of fetish of people that are interested in wallowing in mud, and it's just sort of this idea that you're getting sort of into the primordial ooze and squishing things between your hands and toes. I shoot these videos, and I have this top-secret location. It's the perfect mud pit. And I could tell as he was telling me this, you know, he was almost foaming at the mouth as he was telling me about, like, it was the perfect mud. It was, like, the perfect consistency. And I asked him, you know, I said, hey, you know, well, where is it? And he said, insisted that, you know, this is top secret. He cannot tell me because there's other people out there that are interested in this mud pit. And if they find out about it, they'll come to it. And then it won't be my mud pit. It'll be defiled. At one point, some friends of mine who were responsible for throwing these crazy Halloween parties called Disturbathon, they were throwing another one of these parties, and they wanted to make a giant pit for people to wallow in. So I enlisted Tim, the Mud Man, to help us construct the perfect mud pit. Tim came in, like, I mean, he was like a scientist, bringing in all this specific dirt and powdered things and created like this perfect 3-foot-deep mud pit. He insisted that, you know, it has to be the right consistency. It has to be the right temperature. Everything has to be perfect for this mud pit. And, you know, he did it. I mean, he created this amazing, beautiful pit of mud that you got in it and it was just like you were, it was almost like this all-encompassing sort of womb-like feeling. As the years passed, the video collection kind of began to take over more, and the book collection sort of started to take a little bit of the back seat. And at the time, I remember the internet was just kind of starting to pick up, and Amazon had just started, and the fetish and the pornography stuff was very profitable at the time. So I started renting more of this stuff, you know, the sexploitation schlock films of the 70s and the 60s, and people were renting it, and it was making good money. So at the time, the Dallas Vice started doing some undercover sting operations, and they were hitting video stores and bookstores and comic book stores and, you know, going into places and purchasing items that they deemed pornographic and coming back and issuing warrants for people that were working that sold this stuff. So they had hit my shop, Forbidden, and they had hit a couple of comic book stores for selling underground comics as well. And I had a lot of the underground comics too in my shop. So a few months passed, you know, on my way back from a trip, I got pulled over in some very small town, and the officer, you know, was going to give me a warning because I was maybe going a little bit above the speed limit. And he pulled up and saw that I had a warrant for my arrest for this offense. Obscenity is what they called it. I didn't have any prior problems on my record, so I just, you know, I worked out a deal with the judge and the prosecutor and paid a small fine because it was a first offense. At first, to me, it was an issue of freedom of information. You know, we should be able to have all this stuff. I mean, that was part of the idea of why I started this, was that, you know, we should have the freedom to rent pornos if we're of age. We should have the freedom to buy a book that tells us how to grow marijuana. It kind of was starting to dishearten me about the whole idea that if these Vice are going to just kind of continue to come in and nitpick at my store and keep issuing warrants, then, you know, I just decided, well, it might be a good time to exit. And so I sold the store to a customer that was very much interested in it and moved on to my art gallery and continued that for a while. It's been an interesting journey to meet, you know, all the unusual people. I mean, even though they lead these really odd and strange lives, I think each one of them leaves me with some sort of like part of them, you know, where I'm kind of have a greater understanding of my life and my purpose.
Jason Cohen may no longer be trafficking in the forbidden, but he is still dealing in the rare. Today, he operates a Dallas emporium called Curiosities and a spinoff shop called Curious Garden. Oh, and it's still very much a family affair. His partner at Curiosities is his antique dealer mom. Lori Herzl is the senior editor for books at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, where she has worked for more than two decades. But she once had a very different brush with literary greatness. That was the summer she spent living with her dog, Toby, in the attic of James Thurber's childhood home. Thurber, of course, is the beloved American humorist, cartoonist, and author. His work for The New Yorker includes probably his best-known story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Thurber died in 1961, but an ornate Victorian he once called home in Columbus, Ohio, is now a literary arts center and museum in his memory. Thurber himself believed the place was haunted. It even served as inspiration for his story, The Night the Ghost Got In. For Lori, whatever was in the house made its presence known just 3 days after she arrived.
This happened to me back in 1992 when I was the writer in residence at the James Thurber House, which is in Columbus, Ohio, where Thurber grew up. So when I went down there, I was there for the summer, and I knew that the house was haunted, but I don't really believe in ghosts, so I wasn't really too worried about it. I went down there in June with my dog, Toby, and the first day that we were there, it was a bright, sunny Sunday afternoon when I arrived, and I was up in the attic, which is where Thurber's grandfather had lived when the Thurber family lived there. And if you know the book, My Life in Hard Times, you know about his grandfather and how the bed once fell on him. But the attic has been completely remodeled since then. It's a really nice writer's apartment with two bedrooms and a big sunny living room and a little kitchenette. So I was unpacking my computer in one of the two bedrooms when I heard my dog, Toby, start to growl. Toby never growled. Toby never barked. He was kind of a howler, but he was not really a growler. So I went out into the living room, and he was staring at an empty chair, growling. Now, this was a Sunday afternoon, and the place was full of sunlight. There was nothing on the chair, not even a pillow. There was nothing in the room for him to be growling at, but he was growling at this chair. And I could not break his concentration. I tried grabbing him, but his hackles were up, his shoulders were tense, and the hair was up on his back, and he just kept growling at this chair. Now, I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel like there was a chill in the room. I didn't see a ghost, but it was a very strange behavior from Toby. So the thing that always would get Toby's attention was a tennis ball. So I threw a tennis ball down the hallway, and he ran after it, and that was that. So that was our first experience with the ghost. And then as the summer went on, this ghost started making itself apparent to me. Other writers in residence who had lived in this apartment had told stories about waking up in the middle of the night and seeing a strange man by the bed. Thank God that did not happen to me. Others talked about seeing a reflection in the glass of the pictures on the wall. That also did not happen to me. But what did happen to me was other things. One morning, I woke up and all of the couch cushions in the living room had been piled up in a big pile on the living room floor. That is probably something that Toby could not manage, although he was a very smart dog. One day I came home and the windows were open. And this was unusual because it was so hot in the attic and it was a very hot summer. So we kept the windows closed and had the AC going all the time, but the windows were open. So that was odd. There was another day when suddenly the water in the bathroom just turned on and started pouring into the sink. So all of these things made me kind of unnerved, but there were also possible explanations for all of them. But still, there were really no explanations for the footsteps, which I started hearing in the middle of July, and I heard them every night for about 2 weeks. I would sit in the apartment reading or watching television, and around 11 o'clock or midnight, I would start to hear footsteps of somebody walking back and forth on the floor below. It's where the bathroom was and James Thurber's bedroom was. The whole house was a museum, and the bedroom was preserved exactly as it was when Thurber lived there when he was in high school. The steps made me really nervous because it was late at night. There was nobody around. This was before cell phones. I was the only person in the house, just me and my dog. One night it finally made me angry and I leashed up Toby and we went downstairs and we walked all the way through the house and I never saw a thing and I never heard a thing and we went back upstairs and the footsteps started again. And Toby heard them too. When the footsteps started, he would sit up and kind of look around and finally it got to the point where I would say, "It's just the ghost," and he would lie down again. Toward the end of the summer, I walked through the museum with Toby, maybe 8 o'clock at night, just because it was such an interesting museum and it was a nice time of day to kind of wander through. It was closed and all of the tourists were gone. There was a little bookstore that I liked to browse in. So we were browsing around and Toby wandered off and then I heard him growl again. And he had not done this since the first day we arrived. And I went out and he was standing in the doorway of the living room of the museum. And he was growling at the couch. There was nothing on the couch. There was not a pillow on the couch. There was not a blanket on the couch. The light was coming through the window. It was beautiful. There was nothing there, and he was growling. So I thought, well, I need to just go in there and kind of get up close to the couch and see if there's a shadow or something weird that's got him upset. And he wouldn't let me walk into the room. He kept blocking the entrance to the living room. And he kept growling, just staring at the couch, not moving, just like before with his hackles up and his fur up. And this went on for about 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds. And then he stopped growling, and he just kind of walked up to the couch and sniffed it all over in one spot, like something had been there, but had disappeared. But again, I felt nothing. I didn't feel a ghostly presence. I didn't feel a chill from beyond the grave. I felt nothing, and I was very glad that I felt nothing. My last weekend there, my friend Joey flew out to Columbus, and she and I decided we were going to drive back to Minnesota together. So there was a little tiny bedroom at the very top of the stairs in the attic, and then a long hallway, and then the apartment where I was living. So she spent the night in the little bedroom at the top of the stairs. And in the morning, I got up, and we made coffee, and I said, you know, as you always do when you host somebody, how did you sleep? And she said, well, I think I would have slept better, except something woke me in the middle of the night. Something was shaking my bed. So we were glad to get out of there. And it's funny to tell this story because I really don't believe in ghosts, but I don't really have any way to explain all of the strange things that happened that summer in Columbus. And I'm not sure that Joey could explain what exactly it was that was violently shaking her bed to wake her up in the middle of the night. And Toby, you know, he's not talking.
If you're curious about the Thurber House, you can find a list of public events on its website. In fact, the nonprofit leans into its haunted reputation. This past October, it raffled a chance to win a private ghost investigation. And while Herzl's beloved dog Toby has sadly passed on, she is doing quite well and continues to edit and write at the Star Tribune. Thomas Riccio believes in chance, that things occur because they need to occur, and that we're in dialogue with the universe. Chance is how the spirits speak, he says. It's how they guide you. Riccio thinks about these things a lot. He's a Dallas-based artist and professor who has studied indigenous performance for years. He teaches courses in shamanism, ritualism, and visual narrative. Put simply, he's a performance anthropologist. And that's how, by chance, he met somebody at a cast party in the early 1990s who offered a strange invitation. Please come to Siberia. More specifically, the densely wooded Republic of Saha, also called Yakutia, one of the coldest inhabited parts of the world. He would be a guest of their national theater company and work closely with their Ministry of Culture. They wanted Riccio's help in revitalizing their cultural traditions and modernizing them for tourists. But perhaps the real reason Riccio accepted was that it also meant he would get to meet the shaman, a powerful leader he had heard about and read about, who lived deep in the Siberian woods, accessible only by an hours-long drive on rough dirt tracks. But chance is a funny thing. Here's Thomas.
Finally, I'm going to visit the shaman. I can't say his name because if I repeat it, he'll come. That's how he left me. This is probably one of the most powerful shamans in all of Saha. I'd read about him. I saw his shaman's robe in museums, you know, which is very intricate. And he's from like 7-8 generations of shamanism. And so this man is like, he's the real deal. We go there. We go to his compound. And as my translator is going in, because it's unannounced, this is before internet, he had no telephone. They go in, and as they're going in, I'm walking around the compound because, you know, I'm a performance anthropologist. I want to see what the terrain is and what we're doing there. So I'm walking around the compound. And, you know, it looks like a farm because there are a lot more farmers and there are shamans on the side if their livelihood is farming, agriculture. And then my translator comes out and she goes, he's not a shaman and he won't see you. It's like, what do you mean? I mean, No, he's not a shaman. I go, he says he doesn't want to see you. And I go, okay, I don't know what's going on inside there, all right? I can't speak the language. Could you just say I came a long distance, and if I could just say hello, and I have a gift I bought for him, if I can present the gift, I'd be happy. And she said, that's fine. All right, so she went in, she came back again and said, he agrees to it. I can have only 20 minutes with him, and I can ask no questions about shamanism, and he's not a shaman. I go, fine. I have no idea what's going on. I go inside, and he's a beautiful man like mid-80s. I shake his hand, and his hand is like, it's like a part of a tree, you know? It's just like beautiful, gnarled. It's very earthy, and he's a very earthy person, and just beautiful to look at. And I go, how are you? And he responds, my soul is gone, and I'm waiting to die. And with that, I recognized why he said he wasn't a shaman. Because they believe that there are two souls. There's the human soul and then the shaman soul. The shaman soul has basically left him. The shaman soul came to him when he was younger and now it left. And all he's there is like a husk of a human waiting to die. And that's exactly how he felt. And so he wasn't, in his mind, a shaman, even though he contained the knowledge. He was no longer like sacralized by the belief or by the shamanic powers. I was there ultimately almost 4 hours. I never asked one question of shamanism, but he answered every question I had. Because if I say, how did you learn to sing? Of course, it's going to be related to shamanism. And he related how when he was 17 or 18, he was in the field working and his father was a shaman, his great grandfather, et cetera, going back many generations. And he started singing uncontrollably. He couldn't stop. And so they put him in a yurt. And there he sang nonstop for several days. And what was happening is the spirits were singing shamanism into him. They're like pouring it into him. He's just singing. And he recited some of the songs. It's almost, and I go, are these songs? He goes, no, they're just the voices of the spirits coming to me in like poetic musical form. That's how they enter. And it was uncontrollable. Then I asked him about drumming. And of course, the drumming, which is very important to create alpha waves in the mind and to create a state of trance. The drumming also came to him through the spirits, but they taught him, but he never like took a class. So he told me all these things about shamanism without talking about shamanism directly. He then took us out to this area, which is these poles, these totems, which each one is marked and they're aligned with lunar movements because they're very lunar oriented. And so at various times the moon will cast a shadow. And then that's how, this is their circle where they shamanize. The thing is, which is remarkable even to this day for me, when I was waiting, because I waited for several minutes, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes when they were inside talking, I walked all the way around that area and I didn't see anything. It wasn't like it was heavily cloaked in trees. I just didn't see it. All right, and I had walked, you know, I wandered around, I didn't see it, and all of a sudden it was there. It was like he had to like show it to me. So to this day I'm puzzled by why I didn't see it then. Because I even took photographs. You know, I'm out there, I'm doing documentation, I took photographs, and in my photographs that I took prior to entering, there's no indication of this lunar circle. But then afterwards I'm inside of it. And it's right near where I just was. On the other side of the fence. So, puzzle, right? He shows us everything, how it's operated, never mentioning shamanism, just saying which power different parts of the moon have. And then he shows us his tree. He has a shaman's tree. And the tree is marked by, there are 9 birds. And each bird represents another level of his evolution as a shaman. And the tree is, it's attached to, so it's just like this vertical rough-hewn wood, a tree limb, with these carved birds on it going upwards. And the birds, first they're big, and then they get smaller and smaller and more agile. The tree it's attached to, the best way to describe it, imagine a tree that's now upside down, where the roots are to the sky. Right? And it's carved that way. And at the end of the branches that point to the sky, they're carved like antenna. And that's, and there are two reasons for that. One is the shaman inverts the world. a shaman exists between spaces. They turn, essentially, they turn the world upside down. And then what they're doing is turning, meaning the material and the spiritual world, inside out. That's their role. And that's symbolic of that. And on it, there were several totems of his various spirit benefactors. And in the crevices of the tree that was carved, you saw coins and ruble notes, like propitiations. So it's beautiful, right? We have lunch there. We chat more. We get, you know, his wife cooks this beautiful peasant Siberian lunch for us. Beautiful summer day. And we depart. And when we depart, he says something very profound and significant for me. He shakes my hand and we spend a few moments of silence together. And through my translator, he says to her that whenever I need him, I should just call his name and he'll come. And he has. He's been dead now probably 15, 16 years. But he will. And I can't say his name because I will call him. And I don't need to call him now. It's my 911, my spirit 911.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Thomas Riccio's work has led him to yet another frontier, artificial intelligence. He's collaborated on videos for Hanson Robotics about Sophia, the world's most recognized humanoid robot. Strange is produced by me, Jason Reimer, and Jeff Whittington, who also edits the show. Strange was created by me and Jason Reimer. Jason also composed our music. Additional music provided by Talented Friends Productions. You can find all of the details in our show notes for this episode. Our artwork is by Rob Wilson. Additional audio provided by Spoke Media. And special thanks to Edward Medellis. If you like Strange and want to help support this work, please rate and review us wherever you're listening and tell all of your friends. It helps others find the show. And if you have your own strange story, I want to hear it. Please drop me an email or a voice recording through my website, strangepod.com.